You're listening to Get Fed Today, one podcast designed to provide the Christian a hearty Bible study 5 days a week. While our mission is to showcase a variety of different Bible teachers, if you want to access more content from a particular pastor, simply listen to the end of the episode for additional information. On behalf of the entire team at Get Fed Today, it is our prayer that today's episode encourages your growth in the grace and knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ.
The book of Judges presents for us some interesting characters. One of my favorite characters that you find in the book of Judges is a total coward. I mean, God uses him in a great way, but he's a coward. Like, full stop. His name's Gideon. Now, during this particular time of Jewish history, a period we know as the Judges that begins with the death of Joshua and will continue all the way up to the birth of Samuel, you go through these cycles of Israel's obedience to disobedience, God's correction, recycle, rinse, repeat, we do it over again. Gideon finds himself living in a time where you have the Midianites, who were really a people without a territory. They were primarily a nomadic tribe. God was using this people to judge Israel. And the judgment was very simple. God would allow the Jewish people to till the land, plant the seed, yield a crop, and just at the time of harvest, when everything was ready, that they could experience literally the fruit of their labor, God would allow the Midianites to come in and take it all. And that's where we find Gideon. In fact, chapter 6, the book of Judges, beginning with verse 11, we read, "Now the angel of the Lord," who, spoiler alert, is Jesus, "came and sat under the terebinth tree," which was in Ophrah, "which belonged to Joash the Asbronite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites." Now, most of us are not real, you know, consistent or up to speed on harvesting, especially wheat. I don't know if that was your bucket list for next weekend or not. But in regards to threshing wheat, what you would want is a good source of wind. So most people in a normal situation would find a hilltop, which is where you would put a threshing floor, and then you would take the wheat, you'd throw it up, you'd let the wind blow through it, separating the chaff, the heavier wheat would fall, and that's just kind of how you refined your crop. Well, we're introduced to Gideon, not at a threshing floor, not up into a wind-blown area, but he's in hiding because of course, the Midianites, and he's in a wine press, which is a hole in the ground, often cool, where you keep wine. You know what you don't find in a wine press? Wind, which is like the most essential thing you need to separating the chaff from the wheat. And so literally you've got Gideon, Jesus is watching, and you've got Gideon throwing up the wheat, trying to separate the chaff and the grain. And Jesus is watching. And with that in mind, notice Jesus' first words to Gideon. Verse 12, "So the angel appeared to him and said to him, 'The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor.'" He's not a mighty, he's in hiding. He's not a mighty man. So Gideon replies to Jesus and says, "Oh my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all the miracles which our fathers told us about?" And then he just starts complaining some more. Basically, he's like, "You want to know why I'm in this wine press doing this? Because God's not doing nothing. Where's God?" Now, keep in mind, he's talking to God. Not a really good situation. Now, Jesus is going to work in Gideon's life. He's going to reveal himself in some really radical ways. In fact, I would encourage you just on your own, read through chapter 6. Like, it is an amazing chapter, what God does in Gideon's life. But Gideon is still just kind of a cowardly guy. Now, fast forward to verse 33. We're given the scene, kind of the preparation for a big battle. So all the Midianites and Amalekites, the people of the east, gathered together, and they crossed over and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew the trumpet. The Abizarites gathered behind him, and he sent messengers throughout all of Manasseh. and gathered behind him. He sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, Naphtali, other tribes of Israel. And they came up to meet them. So you have these two people groups preparing for battle in the Valley of Jezreel. God has worked in Gideon's life, I mean radically, revealing himself profoundly. And Gideon's looking at the situation. He's like, well, we're actually going to go to war. And I'm the leader, and he gets a little cold feet. So verse 36, Gideon says to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, that's a bad starting point. I know you said you're going to deliver Israel, and I know you've said you're going to use me. I know this is what your word says, but can we verify it? Look, this is what we'll do, God. I'll put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. So he knew where the threshing floor was. If there is dew on the fleece only, which he obviously got from Old Navy, and it's dry on the ground, then I'll know that you will save Israel by my hand as you have said. And so it was. When he rose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl of water. All right, God, I know you've told me this is how this is going to go. You're going to use me. We're going to liberate Israel. This is the plan. It's your word. But just for verification, we're going to run a little experiment. If you'll indulge me, God, I'm going to put a fleece out. And if everything is dry but the fleece, well, then I know you've really been speaking to me and I've been listening. I think this is a good experiment. And God obliged, and it was so. Next morning, everything's dry. The fleece is soaking wet, wrings it out, a bowl full of water. That's a supernatural thing. That's not a normal occurrence. That should be end of story. Gideon, I'm behind you. Verse 39, then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me. Again, not a good way to start a prayer. God, I know what I'm about to say might induce a little anger. Don't be angry. Let me speak one more time. Let me test. I pray. Just once more with the fleece. Let it be dry only on the fleece, but on the ground let there be dew. Let's reverse the experiment just so the first occurrence wasn't a quinky-dink. And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground. We have certain phrases that we use in Christian circles that don't really translate well outside of Christian circles. I call it Christian ease. You know, say, man, church was on fire this morning. You say, what? Did you call the fire department? Was it like we understand in the church world what that means, but like it's just it lands differently on a secular ear. Another one of these we find from this passage, and that's the idea of throwing a fleece. Well, I'm not sure what God wants me to be doing. You know, I've got option A, I've got option B, I've got option C, and I kind of know what God's word has said, but I just kind of want a little confirmation. He's asking me to take a step. I just need to be sure. God's word's not enough. Don't be angry. And I'll throw a fleece. So I'll play, I'll test, I'll work something out with God. You do this, God, and I'll know that you really want me to go down that path. The interesting thing about throwing a fleece, this is in a biblical context, is that while God does indulge Gideon, because he's a coward, he doesn't really do that often. Like God's really kind of not in that business. Go back to the father of our faith, Abraham. Leave Ur of the Chaldeans, that's great, where are we going, God? To a land, that's cool, that I will show you when. I don't know, just go. Does Abraham ever find the land? No, he keeps moving all the time. The land was ultimately heaven, but it was the journey that God was calling Abraham to. Be obedient, go. Like so often, And you can understand Gideon, and I'm not knocking the idea. Like, we want to know God's will for our life. I think that's a fair thing. If you're a follower of Jesus, you've given your heart, your life to Jesus, you want your life to be used by the hands of the Master, to be used for his kingdom, to bring him glory. You want your life to have purpose, meaning. And you can actually pray, Lord, I want your will done in my life. I know I can't trust myself. I want your will. I just want to know what it is. And we say, Lord, I want to know what it is, because if I know what it is, I can get ready for it, I can plan for it, I can organize things. That doesn't really require faith or letting go. But that's what we want. We want to know God's plan. We want to know God's will. And we place it in the context of that will or plan being good. God, obviously, you know me, I know me. I'm good looking, I'm eloquent with speech. Obviously, you want me behind a pulpit preaching your word forever to the multitudes, to the thousands. I get it. I know me. I'm the right guy for the job. So you just tell me and I'll get ready for it. What if God's will for your life, where you're like, God, I want to know your will. And God's like, about that, I'm not sure you do. Well, wait a second. Of course it's going to be good. Yeah, about that. Just think about the examples. You got the three amigos, Daniel's buddies, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I imagine they're in a prayer meeting with, you know, they're together. They're in Babylon, spending time before Jehovah. God speaks to him. Hey, boys, how would you guys like to have an encounter with Jesus? Sign me up, God. Your son, the Messiah? Yes. Oh, yes. The angel of the Lord? The guy that appeared to get... Oh, yeah, that's the guy. How would you like to have such a radical, amazing... I mean, this will be such an experience. They'll put it in the Bible. Yeah, God, that sounds pretty good. I'm glad you've recognized us. Okay, so here's the plan. You want to know how this is going to go down? That's even better. Okay, so Nebuchadnezzar the king is going to go on like this ego trip. He's going to build this big tower. He's going to declare that everyone's got to bow down and worship. That's when you say no. Okay, got it down. Big tower, Neb, no, exclamation point. Where does Jesus come into this? Okay, Nebuchadnezzar's going to be really angry about it. He's going to build this furnace, going to make it really, really hot, fiery furnace. And when you say no, he's going to be like, guys, are you sure? And that's when you say, we're sure. Are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. Okay. Fiery furnace. And then what's going to happen? They're going to take you, and they're going to take you to the fiery furnace. And this is when Jesus comes in. No, that's even better. They're going to throw you in. Really? Yes. You'll get thrown in the fiery furnace, and then you'll encounter Jesus. And a radical, even so much so that the only thing that's burned are the ropes holding you. And you'll walk, there won't even be the smell. And Nebuchadnezzar will be like, we threw three guys in, there's a fourth, and he'll even know that it's God. Okay, I get it, God, but we could do all of that, you know, without the furnace thing. No, that's my plan. That's how I'm going to do it. Okay. I mean, Lord, I want to know your will. Do you? My story begins December 19th of 2021. I had just completed the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 7. Didn't realize that I wouldn't preach again for another 5.5 months. I'd take the longest break between Matthew 7 and 8 in history. I walked off stage, loaded up the family, came here actually, picked up my mom and dad, and we went to Kentucky. Met the whole family in Kentucky. We went to the Creation Museum. We went to the Ark exhibit. It was awesome. Didn't know I was going to meet Noah in like a week. We came back on Wednesday, dropped off mom and dad, settled back into the house. Thursday, I went into the office. I had to get ready for Christmas Eve. Start working on sermon prep, getting the whole evening laid out, worship, etc. About middle of the day, Jessica took the boys, took Mabel. They were going to go see a movie. I was going to meet up with them later for dinner. I got cold. It's odd. Just cold. Went in, took a shower, thought that'd kick it. Went back to work. Still cold. Made myself a cup of tea. I don't even like tea, but whatever. Just couldn't kick it. I just had that crud, that feeling. So I text Jessica. I said, hey, you do dinner without me. I'm going to take some Mucinex, a little bit of Benadryl. I'm going to bed. I'm just going to beat it now, give my body a chance to fight it. I'll be fine. Well, I woke up Christmas Eve with a fever. I was running a fever. And so I text the guys at the church. I said, hey, y'all are going to have to go solo tonight. I'm running a fever. This is in the middle of COVID. At this point, Delta was kind of gone. This was the Omicron thing, right? Very contagious, but not very lethal. Like everybody was going to get it, but very few people were going to die or get really sick. It was blowing through the community. And so here I was, I had a fever, I can't go to church. And I'm thinking, this will be fine. Well, I just got worse. Christmas morning was not great, was not fun. I got to the 28th of December, and finally I was sick enough where I was like, I need to go to the doctor. Hadn't been to the doctor since 83 when I was born. But we need to find a doctor. We went to the emergency room because I knew that there were doctors there. I took literally 2 steps in, looked around. I was like, not for me. Walk back out. Found a doctor, went in. The nurse said, and I quote, you lit up the COVID test. Okay, cool. Met with the doctor. The doctor's like, it's a Tuesday. You'll be fine by the weekend. No big deal. Jess was feeling bad too, so we just assumed that she had COVID. We just hunkered down for the week. Most of the people we had known by that point had COVID, been fine, bad flu, moved on. Well, Friday rolls around. It's the promised weekend that I'm going to be better, and I'm not better. At this point, I've got a very wicked cough. Go back to the doctor. I said, Doc, you lied to me. It's the weekend. George is playing tomorrow night. This is not good. He goes, well, let me give you something for the cough. Again, hunker down, plenty of fluids, Gatorade. You'll be good. Well, Tuesday, it's January 4th. Been real sick. Jessica's been real sick. I didn't even know it, but my mom had come and gotten the boys like 2 days before that. I had no idea. I thought my children were home. I go to get out of bed, and I collapsed. Jessica helped me to the restroom. I sit down on the toilet, and I look down, and my fingers and toes are blue. I'm not a Smurf, so that's not the right color that you want your fingers and toes to be. So I looked at Jessica and I said, you need to call 911. I said, something's wrong. So Jessica grabs her phone and she does what she's supposed to do. She calls my mom. Because when I get sick, I'm a baby about it. You know, like most guys, I'm a baby, I'm a wimp. I'm not that sick. My fingers and toes are blue, woman. So my mom says, Jessica, you need to call. If he's saying call 911, call 911. So the paramedics get to my house, and they come in, and they find me. And they're like, Mr. Adams, do you need help getting up? I was like, no, I can get up. So they walk me out, and they've got the stretcher sitting there in my living room. And they load me up. Now, in my mind, I'm thinking, man, I'm dehydrated. I need maybe some oxygen. I'm coughing real hard. I'm thinking, and to be totally honest with you, I'm thinking I'll go to the emergency room, probably won't even get admitted. They'll give me some IVs, some fluids, and I'll be home later that night, maybe tomorrow morning. Not a big deal. And honestly, the EMTs, I come to find out that they're trained for this, but they were cool, calm, and collected. I mean, there was no like urgency or, you know, energy about it. They rolled me out. Friends, the moment the doors to the ambulance closed, it was like a war zone. They cut my shirt off. We gotta go. Some guy's jumping in the front. All I know is that like the whole thing changed on me. And I wasn't ready. And so I start fighting. I mean, this guy's on top of me with his mask pushing it on my face. I'm like, that's not friendly. So I'm fighting him. I'm fighting him because I think he's suffocating me. I didn't realize that I was suffocating internally, because what I didn't know and what they didn't say, but they knew the moment they got to me at the toilet, was that my blood oxygen level was at 42. Which is why my fingers and toes were blue and my organs were going into failure. I would have died within an hour. If I had not gotten out of bed, Jessica would have found me in the morning, passed away. So this guy's got this mask on my face, and I'm fighting him. Got full arm sleeve, tats, big beard. I'm thinking, I got you, bud. And he looks at me in the eyes, and he says, stop it! Now, he used some colorful language that's not appropriate for the church setting. But the gist was, you're not dying on me tonight. Wait, what did you say? I didn't know that was in the cards. I remember the drive to the hospital. They took me to Piedmont Walton. Yeah, we live out in the country. And I remember the first night, part of it anyway. And then the next thing that I know is it's the end of February, which we'll get to in a moment, what I've been told happened since. And a lot of you know this story because you were living it with my family. I didn't really realize until later how bad things were until I saw the video of my dad standing right here with Pastor James behind him saying, I got nothing in the tank and I got to take a few weeks off to focus on my family. If you know my dad at all, not that he doesn't love his family, but he don't like being not in the pulpit. And it was like, wow, that's heavy. I went, my kidneys failed. My lungs weren't working. I was blood transfusion, dialysis, you name it, every test you could do. I mean, I'm on full-blown life support. My lungs are not working. At some point, they have to vent me. I'm fighting all of that, so they sedate me. They put me down. They put the vent tube down my throat. They put a feeding tube down my throat. And they're like, we're not equipped for Zach. So we need to transfer him. They end up landing a bed in the ICU at Piedmont Atlanta, which is where they took me. Now, because of COVID, there was about 10 days that nobody could visit. So I'm on my own for about 10 days, no visitors. Which, in God's grace, was good because Jessica was very sick. And so it allowed my mom to turn her attention on Jessica. She was very close to being admitted to the hospital herself. She wasn't, praise the Lord. A different doctor threw the kitchen sink at her. So she had 10 days to get better. My kids are living with my parents. We had dear friends. We had dear friends in our church at Calvary 316. Joe knew where my Heidecke was. They went middle of January to my house to remove the Christmas tree, to clean up all the presents. It was like a bomb had gone off. And that's just because they didn't want at some point Jessica to come home to that. So they cleaned everything. Jessica would spend a good month or so with my parents. My brother-in-law is getting the reports from the nursing staff. He's relaying those to my parents. You can go onto Facebook and kind of follow the progression. It wasn't good. My numbers weren't good. Everything that everything that people had seen go wrong, was going wrong. They're finally able to get into the hospital to see me. They hadn't moved my mask, so I'm missing a chunk of my ear. I'd like to say that it was a Mike Tyson Make-A-Wish event. I was in bad shape. Every bit of news was bad. Nothing was good. I would be vented for 65 days. So they tell you that if you're vented, your chances of survival drop dramatically. And then the longer you're vented, the less likely you are. I only know of one person that was vented longer than I was and survived. It just didn't happen. One person. Piedmont, Atlanta, the lowest oxygen level they had survived was 75. February 1st, well, the end of January, they start trying to wake me up. So they're pulling back the sedation meds. They're trying to get me to wake up. They're concerned about my vocal cords because of the tubes going down my throat. So that's they decided to trach me. So they move the ventilator to my neck. And then they put the feeding tube in my gut. Still not waking up. February 1st rolls around. They do a CT to see if I'm still there. I was. The dreams were lucid, gnarly. We can talk about that at another time. I was still very much there dealing with some interpersonal relationships. It was quite an experience. My oxygen was only at 55, February 1st. I'm fully vented. I'm on 100% oxygen. You let a cigarette in that room, we'd blow up. There's nothing more they can do. And so that was the day that they came in and the doctor told Jessica that I was going to die and that she needed to go ahead and get her affairs in order and that she would be a widow. That happened, if you know anything of the story, that February 1st happened to be the day that my mom, when she was a little girl, she was 10, got the news that her daddy died. My son Quincy was 10. February 1st is when they get the news. Needless to say, there was a lot of tears and anguish, and only thing that was left was prayer, and you guys rallied. People prayed. All over the place, people prayed. I'm sleeping, and people are praying. Well, they broke protocol on the 3rd of February, and they let my brother and sister into the ICU to say goodbye, Mackenzie and Natalie. And within an hour or so, with no explanation whatsoever, my oxygen level went from 55 to 98.5. And I woke up. When I say I woke up, I kind of opened my eyes. Again, I don't remember any of this. This is February 3rd. I don't get solid memories till later in the month. But I woke up. Everybody's freaking out. My brother's running around. They're FaceTiming, you know. Now, the respiratory doctor called my dad. Because my dad had asked, what do you need to have hope that Zach can make it? And at the time, the doctor was like, he needs to wake up. He's off of all the sedation. There's no reason that he's still in a coma. He needs to wake up. And he's not. Now, at this point, I've woken up, so my dad is asking the logical questions of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the doctor's like, Sandy, you need to really temper the expectations here of the family. Even if Zach lives, which is still an if, his lungs are so damaged from the COVID scarring, COVID pneumonia, that he's going to live on a ventilator. He's going to go home on a ventilator, and he won't have any chance of normality without a double lung transplant. Like, his lungs are shot. And he said, and I quote, your son, he's not going to be able to carry on a conversation. He has preached his last sermon. That's what they said. Well, we just kept working. My first memory. I have no idea what's happened to me. I don't know where I am. I don't know the condition I'm in. All I know is I woke up in the middle of the night. I can't move. Now, I don't know that my arms are severely out of joint. I've got neurological issues. I can't move because I literally can't move. I had gone from 185 to about 125. Atrophy, et cetera. Now, on a side note, my New Year's resolution for that year was to lose some weight. And you know, a lot of your New Year's resolutions, you failed. Not this guy. I nailed it. It's called the death diet. Don't recommend it. So we're in this situation. It's dark. I can't move. Logically, I can't move because I've been restrained. And I start to yell out, but I can't hear anything. I mean, I'm yelling with everything in my being, help! But there's no noise. I've been muzzled. Now, I don't realize I got a tube sticking out of my neck. I got no idea. And it's dark, and all I can see is like this blue and red hue, because I can't see the machines behind me. I hear the beeping and the noises, and I look over. I can see the light under the double doors. And I can hear people walking by, and I can hear carts, torture devices, the rattling of chains. My first memory is convincing myself, I'm Jason Bourne. And I have been taken captive, and I am behind enemy lines, and I'm being tortured for information, but dadgummit, I'm not giving them anything. I have very spotty memories of that room. I remember watching the Super Bowl with my mother. My brother came 10 days later, Nick, gave me a shave, spent the whole day with me. No memory of him whatsoever. They rolled me out of that room at the end of February because it sprung a leak. Literally, there's water pouring out of the ceiling. Shows what kind of hospital care you get when they think you're gonna die. And the moment that they rolled me out those double doors was the first moment. It was like the light bulb went off. I was like, I'm in a hospital. Did you guys know I was in a hospital? And from that point forward, I had full memory. Everything clicked. Now, I had in the course of it all, I had on two different occasions, I had what was called a pneumothorax. So my right lung collapsed. The first time it collapsed, I believe it was in transport when they were moving me hospitals because it was an emergency procedure. Basically, what happens is when your lung, as tattered as mine is, when it pops a hole, it's pushing air into your chest cavity, which creates a pressure zone, and that collapsed the lung. So you need to reinflate the lung, so you got to let the air out. So they take a tube and they stick it between your ribs. I got a cool scar right here to reinflate the lung. Well, the second time, I'm awake for it in the middle of the night. I feel like someone is standing on the right side of my chest. So I page for the nurse to come in. He's like, you're having a heart attack. And I'm like, I don't know if they taught you this in medical school. I could be wrong. I don't know what all has happened to me. Maybe it's moved. But I'm pretty sure that my heart is on this side. And the pain is on that side. No, you're having a heart attack. So they wire me up, and I'm looking at him. I'm like, some heart attack. He goes, okay, you're right. I was like, I know I was right 30 minutes ago. So they do the x-ray. Sure enough, my lungs collapsed. They had to poke another hole, and that set me back. Like, we were making progress. I was working to try to get off the ventilator, and everything got set back. And then that became a whole thing, whole process. They had to do they couldn't do surgery on me because I wouldn't have made it. So this doctor comes in and he says, Zach, I have a plan. Good. I don't. Glad you do. He goes, we're gonna do something that they used to do in the 50s. And I'm like, that's where we are now. Modern medicine is no longer working. We're going back to the good old days. Leave it to Beaver. He goes, we're gonna take talcum powder. What talcum powder is? You watch a World War II movie, it's the powder that the medics running around, open wounds, pouring powder in to get them back to the tent, coagulates. We're gonna take talcum powder. Okay, I'm tracking. And we're gonna mix it with 100 milliliters of alcohol. Okay? And we're going to pump it into your chest cavity. And then we're going to put your feet over your head for 30 minutes. And then we're going to put your head over your feet for 30 minutes. And then we're going to get you on your side for 30 minutes. And when we're going to flip you on the other side for 30 minutes, we're going to do that just for 4 hours. Okay. The most brutal thing I've ever experienced in my life. About 20 minutes in, I'm screaming. Because they're like, we can't sedate you because Zach and sleepy time don't go well together. But it worked. Basically, it seared my lung and glued it to my chest cavity, which is a fun trick when you go get an x-ray because it's like, ta-da. You've never seen that before, have you? With my lung finally healing to an extent, at least no longer leaking, we started this process of rehabilitation, trying to get out of the hospital. I wouldn't leave until March 13th. I went literally from the ICU home. They were ready to get rid of me. Called Jessica. I said, hey, I'm coming home today. She said, you're what? I said, yeah, they're kicking me out. I said, I called Jessica. I didn't do much of anything. My mom called Jessica because my arms didn't work. The day before I left, my great accomplishment was taking 10 steps with a walker and the aid of two nurses across the room. I had zero function of my arms. I couldn't lift my arms. My wrist didn't work. My fingers looked like sausages. I told Jessica, if you want me to go to rehab, I will, but I don't want to. But I knew what it would cost her. I knew what it would take. I got in the car, and she says, I have a song for you. She pressed play, and it was, they tried to make you go to rehab. And you said, no, no. By the way, that lady should have gone to rehab. I got home. I didn't realize, you know, getting out of the hospital was one thing, but I didn't realize what the journey was going to then be. When I say I needed full-time care, like, I couldn't walk. I was in a wheelchair. Jessica would have to help me up into the wheelchair from the couch, roll me around to the bed to help me into the bed. I was sharing with James. I remember laying there at night. I can't move. So glad to be in my own bed. It's cold. And the comforter, you know, kind of slowly moves down the bed. And you're like, I'm getting colder. And like, I can't do anything about that. And I don't want to wake her up because I've already woken her up twice to pee. And so I figured out a knee shimmy where I could bite it. My comforter. She had to feed me, to help me use the restroom. I did in-home therapy. My legs came back fairly quickly. My arms didn't. It was months where I finally got to the point where it was like I could, like, you go someplace. And your fear is, what if I have to use the restroom? Like, I could go out with a friend, you know, to run an errand, but if I've got to use the restroom, it's going to get real awkward for him. Buddy, I got to pee, you know? You pee your pants, man. I ain't to mess with that. So I finally decided, like, I could navigate the house with, like, gym shorts because I made claws, you know? I could claw my way around. I felt like a SpongeBob character. You know, it was ridiculous. I got jeggings, elastic jeans that I could wear out just because I could get them down, I could get them up. I mean, the things you don't think about, you know, it's terrible. My arms were the problem. So I finally, my OT in August, he's like, you need to go see a neurologist. I go see a neurologist. Neurologist does a full workup and he comes back in. He goes, Zach, you're a textbook, man. I mean, you check every box for ICU neuropathy. The fancier term is critical illness polyneuropathy. I said, Doc, those are big words. What does that mean? He goes, I'm going to refer you to a prosthetic center because you're not going to have the use of your arms for years. He goes, nerves do regenerate. And then in my mind, I'm like, I'm not going to play catch with my boys till they're teenagers, which then you immediately get the guilt of the time you're sitting out back and they wanted to play catch and you're too busy watching the game. It's like, I cut an arm off to go back. I get home, it's a Tuesday. I get home, tell Jessica, we cried that night. Now, I have to go on Thursday to get two tests done to confirm, an EMG and a neural connectivity test. But we cried about it Tuesday. Now keep in mind, I don't have a story of faith. I slept through it all. The story of faith is my wife and my mom and my dad and you guys, where you'd get bad news and you'd have to check it to your faith. And it was the phrase, but God. This was the first time I got bad news, and then my faith was challenged. And I go into the office on Wednesday morning. They had got this set up where I could flip things around, had Bible studies I could listen to. And I had not read ahead. I'm in Matthew 12. Had not read ahead. I open my Bible, I hit play, and you know what, of all passages to get in that moment, it was Jesus healing the man with the withered hand. And I'm bawling my eyes out. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me, man. I was like, Jesus, this guy's got one bad arm and one good one. I got two tilapias. Just give me one. I'm telling you, Jesus said, but God, what are you gonna do? Your wife's been a trooper. What about you? Okay. So I go Thursday. They light me up. These two tests, not fun. You've ever had neurological issues? Not fun at all. Well, the neurologist that's doing the test, his sidekick, his buddy, entering the information in the computer, they're giggling. So at some point, I'm like, hey, giggle buddies. You guys gonna fill me in on the joke? So we get done. And he goes, listen, you're supposed to have the consultation with your neurologist. That said, I'm sure you've Googled what you've got. I said, yeah, man. ICU neuropathy, this is terrible. He goes, no, it is. That is terrible. He goes, good thing you don't have it at all. I said, excuse me? He says, no, completely conclusive. You have damage to your radial nerve behind both elbows, which is why you can't lift your wrist. There'll be a moment that nerve will fire and you'll move your wrist. It could be tomorrow. It could be next week, but it won't be more than a month or two. I said, so I go to see my neurologist. He comes in. He goes, so you've read the report. I said, I have, doc. He goes, you must think I'm a terrible neurologist. I said, well, no, you're just a wrong one. And he goes, no, I'm not. He goes, I've been doing this for 35 years. You're textbook. Every box from the medication, like the time I was in the, like everything that you needed to check the box for critical illness, polyneuropathy, I checked the box. He goes, when I saw you on Tuesday, you absolutely had neuropathy. And I'm not changing the diagnosis. That said, I'm not going to argue with the conclusive test of the EMG and neural connectivity test. What happened between Tuesday and Thursday, I don't know. I said, I could tell you. I didn't do that. It was more like. I said, doc, I'll tell you. I said, Wednesday, I opened my Bible, and it was Jesus healing the man with the withered hand. And he said, are you going to trust me? I said, yes. John, very quickly, chapter 9. Verse 1, Jesus passed by. He saw a man who was born blind. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. And for the sake of time, Jesus will heal him. Now the disciples come to Jesus in the presence of a man who's been born blind. This is a terrible plight, especially that time. No technology, is a begging for existence. He's never seen a sunrise, never seen a sunset, never seen his mother's face. He's known only pain and suffering his whole life. And the disciples come to Jesus and say, this guy's got it bad. Why? Give us a cause for his suffering. It's either his sin, which was a belief at the time that it was maybe a sin he committed in utero or something of that nature, or it was the sin of his parents. But in either way, at least it gives us an explanation for his suffering, for his plight. Causation. Biggest struggle I've had. Now, please understand, I've learned a lot. God's taught me all kinds of things. You don't go through that and not learn things. Prioritizing things. Play more and work less, fellas. Your kids are only little for so long. Any older man that's successful will tell you that. Don't waste those years. I'll never say no to my kids playing catch to watch a ball game. I promise you that. But they want to know causation. And I would have, and again, I'm not harking on it, but people would come up and say, Zach, what has God taught you? What is he teaching you through this? I'm a vegetable in a hospital bed, breathing out of the tube. What is God teaching you? Now, the reason that lands weird, at least for me, was the assumption made by the question. For the assumption is that there was something God was trying to teach me in, say, like November, that I was being stubborn, that I wasn't listening to. And God's like, that boy's going to learn one way or the other. And that all of this has happened so I can learn a lesson that I wasn't willing to learn then. That man born blind, why? And what does Jesus say? Jesus says it's really got nothing to do with him at all. It's not his fault. It's not his sin, not his parents' sin, neither. He said that guy was born blind, and Jesus says specifically why? So that the works of God might be revealed in him. He spits in some mud, smacks it on his face, tells him to rinse off, and he's healed. That's an awesome story for every human being but the man born blind. Because you're the man born blind and you're like, excuse me? If it was my sin, at least I have a cause I can deal with. If it was somebody else's sin, I'm a victim, I can still understand it. You're saying that the only reason I was born blind from birth and have lived that way since is so you could heal me right now. Jesus would say, yep. Following Jesus is a dangerous thing. See, I'm fully convinced that at some point God determined that there was a whole group of medical professionals and nurses and doctors that needed to be reminded that he was still there and he still performed miracles. And so God, in his ultimate wisdom, not consulting me, was like, okay, I need to remind them I'm a miracle-working God. What do I do? Okay, well, there's Zach. And you know, he gave me his life, and he told me, you can do with me as you will. Ugh. So you know what? Okay, that's good. He's my servant. I can use him as I want. He gave me permission. I'm going to knock him down with COVID. I'm going to stack the deck so bad that there's no other explanation for his healing other than me. If God had come to me in November and said, hey, this is my plan. I'm going to use you in an amazing way, but this is how it's going to have to go. Is there not another way to go about that? It's like the guy that got the rawest deal in all of the Bible is Lazarus. Lazarus and Jesus are BFFs, they're best buds. And Jesus is like, hey man, you want to help me with something big? The cross is coming up. I got to let people know I got power, resurrection power. Yeah, Jesus, I'm there. Whatever you want, bro. All right, so here's the deal, Laz. You're going to get sick. Okay, I'm all right with that. I can take a bullet. That's fine. You're going to get sick. Real bad. It's going to be real bad. It's going to be real bad sickness. That's fine. And you're going to ask that I would come. Yeah, that's what I would do, Jesus. Here's the catch. I'm not. In fact, I'm gonna wait. Okay, that seems like an odd plan, Jesus, but I'm still with you. You're the master. You got it, you know? Yeah, no, when I say I'm going to tarry, you're going to die. Okay, that seems odd. You'll be there quick, though, right? No, I'm going to let you spend 4 days in heaven experiencing glory. So bad that there's no chance. I mean, you're dead. And your sisters are going to be ticked off. But don't worry, I'm going to come and I'm going to say, Lazarus, come forth. And then guess what? All that fun that you've had in heaven, you're going to have to come back. What? Yeah. But I was just getting settled. Yeah. Well, at least when I get back, Jesus, it'll be all good. Well, that's the thing. The religious establishment's going to want to kill you. That's my plan. Following Jesus. What does that mean? What does that cost? And then who are we to complain when God's will looks different than what we want? You know, we're so selfish intrinsically that we even are selfish about our suffering. We make our suffering about me, myself, and I, the holy trinity of me. No, yeah, there are storms we see in the Bible of correction, Jonah. We see storms of perfection, the disciples, God's trying to teach them something. But like this man right here, it was neither correction or perfection. It was for glorification. It had nothing to do with him. His suffering had nothing to do with him. It was simply a mechanism, an opportunity for Jesus to be glorified. And who are we to complain? I know that's not the most seeker-friendly message. Hey, come to Jesus. And it might get much harder. And you might suffer. And there might be pain. I'll close with this. Again, leading into March, when I was starting to talk, I got they called me the prince of the ICU. The ICU is kind of a dreary place. But I was talking, and they liked me. I was talking like this. And every day I had people coming in, nurses, janitorial staff, doctors, none of them mine, but just to see me. Because nobody had survived. I wasn't one of a few, I was one of one. And I had a young lady walk in right before the shift changed. Jessica was getting ready to leave. She was crying before she entered the room. Young gal, 22, 23. Her name was Ashley. And she says, do you remember me? I said, I'm so sorry. I don't remember you. I don't know if you knew this. I was in a coma, you know. She says, well, I need you to know something. She goes, I was your nurse the day you woke up. She goes, I'm a Christian. I love Jesus. And I knew you were a pastor. And I had met your wife, and I knew your mother, and I knew you had three small kids. And when I got to the hospital that morning for my shift, and I saw I was assigned to you, I went to the restroom, and I broke down, and I started bawling my eyes out, and I was crying out to the Lord, I can't do this. Because every person I've had has died, and I can't do it because you are going to die. At best, let him die tomorrow on someone else's shift, but just not today. Lord, I can't do it today. Don't let him die. And she said, not only did you not die, but on my shift, a miracle happened. And your lungs filled with air, and you woke up. And I drove home that night praising Jesus like I have never praised him before in my life. For I saw a miracle, and my faith was restored. If Jesus sent me to that hospital for her, and that was it, do I have a right to complain? Or the neurologist that needed to know that Jesus was real? My lungs. I went in July, so when I left the hospital, I had about a 20% capacity. Full COVID scarring, not going to heal, not going to go away. I went 3 months later in July to get another x-ray. And it showed 80% healing. The COVID scarring disappeared. The lady was laughing. It was like, there's no explanation for that. I went back in November, and my lungs are as normal as yours. Friends, do I... I'll be real. I didn't want the story. I didn't. Even looking back, I'd have a hard time saying thy will be done, because it was tough. I mean, it was tough. Humbling, embarrassing, helpless. But you know what? It's not my life, is it? And it's not my choice. So, Father, Lord, Lord, your truth sets us free. Lord, there might be some people in here that are in a tough spot because of their own poor choices. May they see that. And there might be some people in here because you're trying to work something out of their lives, and that's a truth. But there are some times that we just live in a fallen place. And you lead us down a path, not of our choosing, so that you can intervene and you can work. And it's not about us at all. It's about you. It's about your will. It's about you being glorified. It's about a message you're wanting to communicate to this lost world. Following your son is dangerous, but it only ends in life and glory. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Get Fed Today. Today's sermon comes from Pastor Zach Adams. If you enjoy the message, you can access more of Pastor Zach's teaching ministry by visiting zachadams.org.